If you're wondering how to navigate government or grow your business or even secure funding for your nonprofit, then this is the podcast for you. Here on Lobbying Insider, we take a look at the intersection between business and government and show how things actually get done. I'm your host, Zach Fink, Director of External Affairs at Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron. Welcome to the program. And we are joined by a special guest today, former Congressman Joe Crowley, who represented Queens for 20 years in the United States Congress, eventually ascending to leadership, was the caucus chair. Thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate
it. Great to be with you, Zach. I also represented part of the Bronx, yes, too, for those 20 years.
That's right. Okay, the district, one of those districts that goes across a couple boroughs. And we should also fully disclose that your brother, Sean, works here with us at DHC, who I consider a good friend.
Well, I consider him a good brother. So
Do you think he heard us? Yeah.
He paid me to say that.
Very Sean. All right. So I do want to dive right in because there's so much I want to ask you. And starting with the Democratic Party and kind of where they are right now, how they got to where they are right now, it seems like they kind of lost the plot.
Well, I think you have to remember we had 4 years of great success. We had a president. We controlled the House at one point, the Senate certainly at one point as well. I think we certainly took a tough loss. There's no doubt about that, and we're still reeling from it to some degree. We've seen, though, some movement, some change. The most recent elections was an indication that maybe there may be some buyer's remorse in terms of Trump. But that there's certainly some pushback in terms of we saw just the lack of a chasm in terms of the recent elections and the special elections, I should say. You know, down in Florida, Republicans won, but they didn't win as much as Trump had won by. They didn't win as much as they have in the past. So there may be some remorse there. But I think you're also seeing presidential candidates start to surface more. You have Pete Buttigieg in Iowa. You have the governor of Maryland and going down to South Carolina. You have the governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz, going into South Carolina as well. So I think they're starting to talk. Even people say, well, I'm not running or I have no plans to run yet. That, you know, I remind people back, I think it was in 2006 or 2007, Barack Obama said the same thing. You know, he was not running. He was...
I don't know how that turned out.
Yeah, I don't know what he was doing, but he wasn't running.
Right, he wasn't running. Yeah.
Buttigieg has been the most, I think, forthright in saying that he's actually exploring this, and he certainly has an infrastructure. He's done it before. He knows what it takes and what the sacrifices are that you have to make to do that. But my focus, really, I think, what we have to look at is that's 2028. It's really about 2026.
Right, the midterms.
And winning back the House of Representatives. I'm not saying it's impossible to win the Senate. I think it's more difficult.
Yeah.
So I think the more focus, I think, from our party needs to be on winning those seats that it will take to take back the majority of the House of Representatives.
When I heard Democrats doing some Monday morning quarterbacking after the losses, there was kind of a split between those who said, well, it was our messaging that might have been off. But then there are some who are saying, and who I tend to more agree with, that it was the message itself, that Democrats didn't appeal to ordinary New Yorkers in the way that they used to middle-class, working-class people. Do you feel as though that is what got away from them?
Well, I think that Trump and the phenomenon that he is, in many respects, I don't agree with much of anything he says.
Right.
But you can't deny that he is a bit of a phenomenon, you know, and... I think that what worked against us as well was the perception of his being persecuted to some degree. I didn't assign myself with that, but I think that coupling that with, I think, Joe Biden's very late decision not to run again. I think what we as a party failed in terms of the mothers and fathers of the party, those who have the influence on the president, was what I say is that when the president had such a successful first 2 years, you know, passed the CHIPS Act, passed the infrastructure bill, you know, and the Recovery Act, there were so many good things there that even after that, when we lost the House, the president continued to tack to the left. And that should have been an indicator that he was trying to avoid a primary, meaning he was going to run again, that he wasn't necessarily going to be that bridge to the future that he was wanted to continue. And maybe that's when people should have been more outspoken in terms of waiting, you know, till he was too late at that point.
It was a disservice probably not to have a primary, for sure. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, there's a new book out, as I'm sure you're aware, by Jake Tapper, which talks about Original Sin, saying that there was kind of a conspiracy, really, within the government to hide Joe Biden's condition from the general public because they thought he was the best guy to be Trump. And to your point, which I was going to ask you, is it possible that some of the younger aides who were kind of giving out the message were either pushing the administration further to the left, and that in turn didn't resonate or turn people off, and who were in the, you know, normally radical center?
Well, I think whether it's the president himself or was the people around him that pushed him towards it, I think the president acquiesced to it. I think the president himself has said, you know, that you know, it was a very difficult decision to make, even to move forward to run again. You know. Right. But it's because I think when you're in that position, it's hard to extract yourself when you have your family involved. You have the staff around you that they certainly want you to continue. They like their positions, et cetera.
For sure.
It's all natural. But as I said to you, I think that others, the more sophisticated mothers and fathers of the party, should have recognized what he was doing and stepped in at that point, or at least questioned it. Held him more accountable in terms of whether you're actually going to be a bridge or not. He had said he was, you know, and Joe's a friend, and I love him dearly. But there's no question, the time that he actually decided not to run really left us with no time for a proper primary and no time, really, to the detriment of Kamala Harris, that she didn't have that opportunity to even build her own image enough, even with all the resources we had. I think you can also look at, you know, consultants and everything else. We spent, you know, millions and hundreds of millions of dollars on this race. It wasn't for our lack of resources. Right. I think it was, you know, when I saw in the end, Harris going to Pennsylvania and, you know, and having the far left candidates come and talk about, talk about immigration, you know, they really were just talking to their base at that point. They weren't speaking to people who were on the fence on that issue. And maybe, I'm talking maybe more directly about Latino men or African-American men. And so I think that there was some tactical mistakes that were made in Pennsylvania and elsewhere that they may have cost the race as well. But look, we can continue to look back on this, and
sure,
we certainly will. And I think it's healthy to do that. But we also have to look towards the future. I don't want any of this to muck up in any way, shape, or form the 2026 election. What we need to do now to be prepared to win the House of Representatives back, and to what agenda will we have? What are we going to present to the American people that is exciting, that is going to, something that's going to resonate beyond inner city blue New York or Chicago or LA or Miami, for instance?
But there is a lesson for the future just in terms of social issues, where, for example, it does seem like the Democratic Party, to some extent, took, you know, black and brown voters for granted and made assumptions about where they were on certain issues. And I think, for the most part, people who are within the party, even blacks and Latinos, are supportive of abortion rights. They're supportive of LGBTQ rights. However, you can't hit it too much over and over and over again, because you're going to lose some of them. Because there are church communities, there are a little more conservative members of the Democratic Party, again, culturally speaking. And that seems to me a lesson that now there seems to be an internecine battle about whether or not to go harder in that direction, or maybe try to de-emphasize some of those cultural issues. Remember, you know, you were around. Mm-hmm. I mean, during the 1990s, Republicans lost again and again on cultural issues. Right. That was the divide.
Right.
They don't want them in the bedroom. They don't want them telling them what to do with their body. You know, and now it seems as though it's almost like the reverse.
They weaponized it against us.
Yes.
They learned from us.
Exactly. And now it's the Democrats telling people what to think and what's an acceptable way to view the world, and hitting people over the head over and over again with these issues.
You know, what I like to say is that Democrats were perceived as getting behind every issue. We get behind every issue, but we're perceived as standing for nothing.
Right.
And I think that, I don't necessarily think that's fair. I just think that's how people perceive the party at this point in time. You know, I think we tried to weaponize abortion again in this last election, and we're successful in many respects in terms of getting states to codify the right. But you look at Montana, it didn't work there in terms of us maintaining that Senate seat. So what people really had the opportunity to do was to go in, codify their rights on the state level, but still get to vote for Trump if they wanted to.
Right.
So, you know, we thought it would, like the marijuana, the pot issue helped Democrats in the past drive out turnout. It didn't really work this way with the abortion issue, because they got an opportunity to vote on that and they had a clean slate. They could do what they wanted now elsewhere. So, you know, you even see with Gavin Newsom in terms of what he's doing right now. he is really trying to remake his image. You know, from the defender of San Francisco to, you know, the now the governor the mayor of San Francisco, the governor of California, on the gender issues, on transgender, on most recently on immigrants and whether they'll get or not get health care. So I think he certainly sees this as that he has to radically change his positioning. I think he'll have a lot to answer for going down the road. But he's certainly someone who's looking at 2028 as well. I think there'll be others, by the way. I don't think it'll just be, you know, a handful. I think it'll be quite a pretty heavy set of folks running.
You know, on a smaller scale, it was interesting what we saw with Governor Hochul's election in 2022, where there was a heavy emphasis on the kind of reproductive rights issue. And you had a situation, you know, New York voters, as you know, are pretty informed voters for the most part. And we had the Reproductive Health Act here. That issue was kind of settled. So when you kept bringing it up over and over again, I mean, she obviously won handily, but it was more of a closer election than people thought it would be. It was been, I think, 5 or 6 points. And people pointed to that message as something you didn't need to keep beating Democratic voters over the head with.
Well, I think that you also look at certain states where the idea or notion or idea that they will lose this right, it wasn't real because it wasn't happening,
right,
even with the overturning of Roe. So I think that to some degree that's true. There's almost like, well, that's taking that away from me, you know. And so I do think it did give some freedom or latitude to maybe say, well, he doesn't agree with me on abortion, but I'm not going to lose that right anyway. So therefore, I can vote for Mike Lawler or I can vote for—
I don't need to worry about it right here where I live in the Hudson Valley.
Correct.
It's a good point.
And that's why I do believe when it comes to winning these seats that Democrats need to win, those marginal districts where Republicans either are in a seat where they took it from a Democrat or where Harris beat Trump and they won. And there's some of the other side as well in terms of Democrats who are fewer that I think are in seats that Trump won that they're in now. We have to win those districts back, not necessarily by national politics, but by really talking to the needs of people in those districts. You know, we talk about the price of eggs. They're still high, right? You know, so it's an economic message. Now, that's where I think we didn't do well as well. You know, the economy was doing great. You know, job numbers were great. Stock market was higher than ever, but people didn't feel as though the economy was working for them. So it was reflective in the price of food, and we use eggs as an example. But affordable housing, we know the crisis we have here in New York City. And it's not just about the cost of it, it's about the availability of that. And that's not unique to New York, it's about around the country as well. Talking about a strong national defense, and that includes a strong border. I've always said, I'm someone who's been very, very, very progressive about immigration. I think we need more immigration. I think it's healthy for our country. But our borders have to have integrity. Without it, we don't have a border. We don't really have a country, you know?
You also can't say everybody has to be vaccinated except the people coming over the border and we don't know where they are.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's a message that didn't work either. But, again, the point about the economy, I mean, you're talking about Democrats being in a position where they're saying, who are you going to believe, us or your lying eyes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the egg prices are high and everyone's saying, well, the data shows, you know, that actually the economy is on the upswing or, you know, don't worry about Joe Biden. He's actually fine. You know, eventually people say, hang on a second. You know, I know what I see. Right. And to your point, locally, you feel the economic pinch. Mm-hmm. You don't want to hear the eggheads on television tell you that the economy is doing great.
Right. And I think whether or not it deserved the response of Trump,
right,
in terms of just turning everything upside down.
Slight overreach,
down.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the whole tariff issue, and that's just one aspect of it. But I do think that in terms of addressing those issues, we weren't talking enough about them.
Yeah.
I think because it showed a frailty. I don't think Harris wanted to be critical of the president because I don't think it's necessarily the president's fault per se. But when you're in the incumbent, you're responsible for good and for bad. You know, and unfortunately, that's the case.
And she also probably should have made a decision to win the election.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, do what you have to do, even if it means distancing yourself from certain policies.
And I think the president would have understood that. I mean, he may not have liked it, but he'd understand it.
I think eventually,
he'd appreciate. He certainly would have been treated a lot better had she won.
For sure.
Than how Trump is treating him now,
sure.
You know.
All right, follow my theory here, because I want to go back to the 2018 election, and I do believe...
No, the 2018, that's like seven, that's like, wow, I'm running out of fingers.
It does go back, and this is where why I think this is so important, because I think, you know, that was the year you lost your seat to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Okay. It's all making sense, right? But I do think that race symbolizes a turning point in the party, and it's because Trump really took politics in a radical direction and eroding faith in public institutions, whether it's the media or anything, or the courts or anything else. And the Democratic response, and in some ways that race typifies it, was we're going to go radical ourselves, right? We're going to go in a direction. You were from a party that was much more pragmatic and old school, and we're going to eke out the center here, and we're going to be for working class people. There's a faction within the Democratic Party who want to go in the other direction, who want to have AOC, who want her to run for president, for example. To me, that's the wrong move. You don't fight radicalism with radicalism. You fight radicalism with rational.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to, you know, maybe go back the 7 years now and be reflective of it. You know, I do think, I go back to the President Trump's victory in 2016. I was there at the Jacob Javits Center. We were waiting.
Me too. This was in Hillary lost. Yeah, I was there.
We were all kind of expecting, you know, history to be made. In some respects, it was. I never thought that Donald Trump would be the first person from Queens to be elected president of the United States, the last person I ever thought of. But I knew instinctively that when that happened, that politics was changing forever. And I kind of expressed it to my wife, Casey, that night as well. And with a 45% Latino district at the time, 46%, you know, in the Bronx and Queens, I was always concerned about, you know, having a strong candidate from the Latino community running. But I think looking back, you know, generally speaking, I think my constituents liked me. I had a very strong, my polling was excellent, and people say you couldn't trust the polls. But I think you have to look back that I had consistent polling showing that I was up 35 points. And I lost by 15.
Yeah,
that's a 50-point turnaround. Just a little over 10% of the eligible population voted. And taking nothing from AOC, because I live by the sword and I die by the sword. She's a talented person. She's a very talented elected official and politician. But having said that, I think just looking back, you know, there was an apathy. You know, people had said that I was apathetic. I really wasn't. I knew what I was up against. I was also running for, you know, higher positions within my own caucus. I couldn't really express that I had an issue here back in my own backyard. That doesn't really bode well if you're running for leadership in your own position. But I lost by, that's a 50-point turnaround. That's not logical. Let's say it was off by 10 points. It's 40 points. 20 points.
30. It happens, right.
It happened. But there were a lot of other when Cuomo ran in September against Cynthia Nixon, who had a higher name recognition than AOC, had more money. And after the euphoria of my loss by the left in my district, Cuomo won my district by 35 points.
And so, Cynthia Nixon only got, what was it, 40% of the vote?
Yeah, overall. I mean, but I'm just talking about my own specific district. Yeah. So, I do think that Trump did radicalize the left. There's no doubt about that. And I felt that in my own area. But I still thought that I was the only thing we were the only thing on the ballot in that June election, which made it more like a special election. So I think there were a lot of factors went into it, but there's certainly no doubt your premise, your thought about Trump radicalizing, you know, whether or not it's really reflective in what happened with my election or subsequent elections as well in Missouri and in Boston, for instance, as well, my good friend Mike Capuano, who lost to the city councilwoman, going to come to me in a moment, but
throw it back.
She also became part of the squad.
And, okay,
when Bush beat Lacey Clay in Missouri,
Cory Bush.
Another example of that.
And by the way, Cynthia Nixon actually statewide was about 35% of the vote, not 40. But in terms of what actually, you know, the outcome was of that, I mean, you mentioned that the polling was a little bit off, at least what you were seeing. I mean, did she bring out new voters? I mean, a lot of people credit Trump. They say, right, like, did he tapped into a voter base that didn't vote previously, that were not regular participants in elections, because a lot of the data, at least the people who use the consultants get, are based on previous voters. Who's most likely to vote? Let's get them out. Was she able to get people who don't normally vote come out?
Yeah, my district had changed. In many respects, the parts of Sunnyside and Woodside and Astoria, for instance, really had radically changed. A lot of it because of the L train, rumors that it was going to be shut down, that people couldn't move to Manhattan out of Brooklyn. They came to Queens, to the 7 Line, and to the other subway lines.
It's amazing that something like that can really, migration patterns.
So
right?
I would meet people coming up the subway from Tennessee, or they're from Chicago, and like, you know, I'm Joe Crowley, and when if we go, oh, I know who you are. Like, I could tell right away that they weren't fans of mine. You know, millennials that were coming off. I lost my hometown by 400 votes, you know, where I'd been elected for over 30 years, you know, of Woodside. So I think they were, you know, again, going, she definitely tapped into that. She used social media incredibly well, something that I came late to the game on, and wasn't quite as adapted as she is certainly with it. And she's proven that even after that. So I say that, and just in the context in terms of setting it straight, in terms, at least from my perspective, I'm sure that, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez may have a different perspective on it, but I think the numbers speak for themselves. Less than 10, just about a little over 10% of the eligible Democratic population voted in my primary.
Yeah.
A lot more voted in the September primary in 2018. And I think that's what really more reflective of really more the general vote or where the general population was reflective more in the Cuomo election of 2018, who I was aligned with at that time.
I just tend to think that the Democratic Party started to lose its way around that time. And in many ways, your race is symbolic of that. And that, you know, there was a time where the Democrats were for the working class and were for the people who felt marginalized. And it just, something happened along the way there. And I think that, you know, it's fair to say that Trump was able to capitalize on that and to tap into people who felt disaffected. And, you know, and there was also an elite issue going on. There's a lot of people out there who felt as though the Democrats became, you know, very holier than thou and were talking down to people. So he, you know, ironically, he's rich and powerful, so I don't know how he would technically speak for them, but to some degree, you know, he always felt left out in New York from society, right? They, you know, him and his father were never part of the real inner circle of real estate moguls and families here, right?
Sure.
I mean, is that part of it, you think?
I think it certainly is. But I also think, you know, that, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a pretty special individual. I mean, she has a lot of great talents. She's also not in any of those. She's an outsider as well in many respects in terms of that, and she never will be. Look, I mean, she ran as a Democratic Socialist. It's hard to really pull back from that. You know, I think moving forward for her, you know, I don't think my district is for socialism. I don't think the state of New York is for socialism. I don't think the country is for socialism. I don't think they believe that the government or the means of production should be controlled by the people. Or by government.
Or that rent is theft?
Well, you know what? I think that they have issues in terms of
housing feeling threatened.
And the cost of that.
And that message can appeal.
And there is certainly a role for government to play in that. I think we have to incentivize more housing creation. So I think there is certainly something to tap into. You know, when people think about Social Security, they don't necessarily think as a socialist program, but it might be to some degree. I think there are certain aspects of social responsibility that we have to help the poor, to help those. You know, when you think about when Social Security was created, less than 40% of the people in this country were able to bury themselves. They don't have the wherewithal to do that. Today, for 33% of the people on Social Security, it's still their only source of income. So we really haven't come that far. So it's there so that we have at least a modicum of support for the least amongst us. And I say the same about Medicare and Medicaid. Without those programs, we wouldn't be the United States that we are today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I still think if Republicans start cutting those programs, they're going to have
it. And I think that's what they're right now in the midst of doing
in the middle of having that debate internally. I think you're right. But, you know, to what you were saying about AOC, I think you're very right. I mean, she's also, you hit it right on the head. I mean, she's unique. Those videos are highly produced. They're very good. They appeal to people. You know, in many ways, she was a celebrity, an online celebrity, not an on NBC celebrity like Trump, but she was like Trump in many ways.
Right. Well, I mean, they actually made a movie about the election, which I still haven't seen.
Is that so? Okay. I'm doing tonight is I'm going to go watch this movie.
But. someone told me, I remember being at a parade and this guy coming up to me and saying, you know, Mr. Crowley, I voted for you. That woman, she stinks and all this. She's horrible. I said, hey, look, I said, with all the respect, I said, yeah, she's a very good person and she's a very good candidate, but thanks for your vote. I had like my John McCain moment apparently in the movie, but I still haven't been able to bring myself to watch it. So.
And it's a documentary or it's an actual?
Yeah, it was a documentary. It was good, rave reviews out of the Sundance and all those other things. Yeah.
So. Yeah, no, I remember Rochelle Boone, rest in peace, who was with our, when I was at New York One at the time, and we went to her live and she actually won. And
sure,
AOC couldn't believe that she actually, she's grabbing Rochelle.
Nor could I.
Yeah.
And I remember though, my mother was there.
Just real quickly, it was not even on our radar in New York when we had picked the races that we were going to be close. Yours was not when we thought it was going to be close.
And my mom was there and, there was a reporter from the New York Times. They never wrote a story about it, but, I was up singing Born to Run to Alexandria and I dedicated to her. And my mom said to the New York Times reporter, see, that's who my son is. My mom passed away a few years ago, but she, good egg. And look, I have to say, you know, God works in mysterious ways. And, you know, my oldest son is very sick. He went to the Naval Academy and graduated in 2022. And he went Marine Corps and we discovered that he has an incurable cancer. And so he's home with us now. And I don't think we could have really been able to take care of him the way we can in a post-congressional career as I could now, you know, in terms of being in Congress. So I think, you know, I didn't want to lose. That wasn't my plan. I thought I had more to give, but in many respects, it may have been for the best. So.
Well, wishing obviously very healthy future for your son. We hope there's a recovery there. And let me just ask you, we're running out of time, but I do want to ask you a little bit. Let me see if I say this correctly. The semi-quincentennial. Okay, that's
excellent.
Was that good? Did I nail
very
it?
All right.
The 250th anniversary of America, which is coming up in next year, right?
2026.
I do remember 1976. Not that well. I was little. That was the bicentennial.
And I don't remember 1922. Okay. I wasn't around.
So now's your opportunity. Tell me just what you're doing and organizing around that. I mean, it's a big anniversary.
Yeah, I was appointed by Leader Pelosi as a private citizen to the A250 Commission, the semi-quincentennial commission created by Congress to plan for the celebration of the 250th anniversary of the United States Declaration of Independence, our birthday. And the president has created his own task force, which I think is more focused on what the executive will be doing in terms of the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue with the military parade and fireworks and things of that nature. I think what we're working on more towards is really reminding America what July 4th meant, what it was all about, the sacrifices that were made back during that time for the freedoms that we enjoy today. And we're doing that through essay contests. We're doing that through a giving day of giving back. All these things people will be hearing more about. You know, there's only a year to go from this July 4th, but it's already started already. So, for instance, just last week was the 250th anniversary of the Battle of Ticonderoga. In April, we had Lexington Concord. Going back to December, it was the Boston Tea Party. In front of us, we have the Battle of Bunker Hill. And moving forward, the biggest battle that ever took place during the Revolutionary War happened right here in New York City, the Battle of New York. And that started on July 4th, 1776. The British invaded from Staten Island and come into Brooklyn, attacked Washington's troops, flanked them through Queens, pushed them out into Manhattan, drive them out of Manhattan. And some small battles we win. We go into Westchester County, we go into New Jersey, go down into Pennsylvania, and then Washington turns around and has a surprise attack at Trenton and really changed the course of the war.
Trenton was the turning point, wasn't it?
It was in many respects, and so was the Battle of Saratoga in 1777. So I love history. I love especially New York's role in that. But this is a national commemoration for many a celebration. You know, all the rights that were talked about being abrogated by then King George, in the Declaration. We haven't always lived up to that, but we're working towards is our constitution is a more perfect union. So to be involved in this, it's a great privilege. I remember the 76 as well. I remember the tall ships. We're going to have that again.
Yeah, they came up the Hudson. Yeah. I remember that.
And we're going to have that again. So it's going to be a lot of fun, I think. But also, you know, to be retrospective, look at ourselves, you know, where we've come, where we have to go, some of the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that's okay. I think that's okay to be reflective of all that.
Absolutely fascinating discussion. Joe Crowley, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
The Lobbying Insider Podcast is a production of Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron, LLP, New York State's premier middle market law firm, practicing in more than 20 areas, including commercial litigation, economic development, real estate, and government affairs. The podcast is produced by Don Tesserero, and our platform manager is Monica Thomas. Be sure to subscribe, and you can get it where you get most podcasts, including Apple, Audible, Google, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Thanks for being with us.